So tonight is kind of part two of the talk I began last week, which is just a series of suggestions for revisiting and beginning practice in 2017. And, you know, there's that old Chinese saying about that living in interesting times is a curse. And, you know, if not anything, I think we're about to be entering a really interesting time period. And in all seriousness, I think that it's really going to call upon the depth and quality of our practice to stay in balance and to not turn away and to stay engaged and to figure out how to do all of that from a positive motivation. So I think I had mentioned at the end of last year, maybe it was on the one-day retreat we had about this, but I had a very odd reaction to the election because I wasn't really that excited about the result. And, you know, I woke up the next morning, and in addition, I think, like a lot of people, being in a little bit of surprise or shock, I had this odd sense of lightness and this sense of, I wouldn't call it enthusiasm, but I think what it was hope. And it wasn't so much, I mean, I'm actually at the moment, I'm just trying to stay completely neutral because I can see my mind trending towards not having hope about the country. So I'm working really, really hard just to stay neutral and open. But what the hope was about was it was so clear to me that things had become so polarized and then the results of that election, that I'm absolutely convinced that we're going to see all kinds of mobilization in this country that we haven't seen for years and years and years.
What do you mean by mobilization?
Well, there's all kinds of different things. I think we're going to see lots of social action. I think we're going to see people standing up for positions who either have been unwilling to do that or have been afraid to do that and feel that the stakes are high enough now that they don't have a choice or that they need to. And I think it relates to what kind of my opening comments that I think for many of us, it's going to take our practices to really stay balanced in the face of this. And as Buddhist practitioners, you know, wanting for things to go as well as they possibly can. And in order for that to happen, all of us need to be well-intentioned. We just cannot afford not to be well-intentioned. That doesn't mean to be stupid, you know. You know, we did a year-long course. We have our last session next Tuesday night, and it was entitled, How Can I Help? And we used several texts, but one of the texts that we used was Ram Dass and Paul Gorman's book called How Can I Help? And it's about bringing service from this perspective into life. And one of the requirements for being in the course was that people had to commit to a minimum number of hours in service. They got to choose what it was, with the exception that it couldn't be service that they were already doing or had done in the past. So, you know, you had to step outside of your comfort zone. And so it was like a really a fascinating course. And one of the people actually chose getting involved in politics. And she'd never been involved before and was kind of apprehensive about it. So she was always reporting on that. And there's really there's a couple of excellent chapters in that book, How Can I Help, by Ram Dass and Paul Gorman, about this issue and about how our deepest intention informs and affects our ability to engage, our ability to have intelligent and thoughtful and kind discussions with people in a political realm that we don't agree with or think we don't agree with, that prevents us from finding common ground, and that if we're actually trying to influence someone else like ourselves or someone in a position, a regulator, which is a lot of the work I do, or a politician, that our intention and the way we present ourselves is everything. Because nobody particularly wants to listen to an angry person. They may have to, but it's hard to listen. And on the one day that we had here, there were several people that we had small groups discussions, and several people who were, you know, kind of like so caught in the drama of what's happening on both sides that they had real difficulty remembering anything at all about right speech. And you know, that's really, really a problem, right? Because we've got this beautiful Dharma Hall, this beautiful center. You know, we're talking about, you know, creating a particular environment. And then in a couple of small groups, you know, somebody just opens up and kind of blasts somebody else that disagrees with them, right? So we have to be the ones that are the example. We have to be the ones that find a place of equanimity and balance and hold the space and influence the discussion by doing that. So I don't know that this has a lot to do with the talk that I was supposed to give tonight, but it seemed awfully important when I started it, okay? So, and maybe it does, because what I'd like to talk about three things tonight, and I think that they're really critical. To the issue that I just raised, they're really critical to sitting practice, sitting meditation. They're critical to mindfulness in daily life, and they're critical if we want to be engaged. And it doesn't matter what we're engaged in. If we actually are going to go just outside the confines of our normal life and engage in some kind of service or political activity, these things are really critical. So the first one is looking at what the historical Buddha said about this practice. You know, and last week we talked about, well, what's the purpose of practice? And the purpose is awakening. And awakening is on a spectrum. You know, there's a spectrum of those people who are exclusively householders and have only so much time to practice, to on the far extreme on the other side, people who are able to lead a monastic or a monastic-like life and devote themselves exclusively to practice. So on both ends of this, you know, it's not like, well, just the monks and the monastics have access to the notion of awakening, because awakening is awakening to the deepest causes and conditions that cause us to suffer, and the deepest causes and conditions that lead our minds and bodies and hearts into satisfaction and happiness. But there are reasonable expectations at each place on that spectrum of what we can expect in any given lifetime. Okay. So how do we end up maximizing wherever we are on that? And the historical Buddha, this is one of my favorite quotations, he said, "I know of no other single thing so conducive to misery than an untrained mind. And I know of no other single thing so conducive to satisfaction and happiness than a well-trained mind." You know, I think we live in a culture that the notion of training and discipline and you know, denying ourselves of certain things to support some other activity isn't very popular unless we're talking about athletics, I guess. But the core, I mean, it's very clear when you read the Buddhist teachings that we're actually talking about retraining the fundamental perceptions and the fundamental approaches of how the mind is engaging our experience and our relationship with others in the world. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing that he is proposing. So, if we're serious about practice, if we want to make progress in the sense of developing, cultivating positive qualities of this practice, and then diminishing those things that are hindering us in our lives, then this notion of training becomes quite important. And looking at it really seriously becomes important as well. So I talked about a few things last week, and you can go back and listen to that tape, but I'd like to talk about two particular aspects of training tonight. One that we may be familiar with that has to do with directly experiencing sensations in our body and in our mind. And then secondly, talking about the content of thought, which we actually don't talk about that much. There's a lot of talk about thinking, but not a lot of talk about thinking in the sense of the actual content of thought and what to do about that in a positive way. Okay. So, as a starting place, and this is the second item that's on this little handout, is it says focus first. It says something close to this because I'm not looking at it. It says focus first on the immediate and direct experience of sensation in the body and the mind, rather than an idea or a concept or an image about experience. Okay, so let me kind of work us into this. It's really common when we do our beginning meditation class, and we've got one starting next month, middle of February. You can go up on the web and register if you're interested. And at whatever level of practice you are, it's a great course, and it's a great course to revisit basics. And if you haven't, if your practice has all been self-directed and you've never taken a course, it's a really good foundation. It's 6 weeks long, once a week, a lot of guidance, homework. So it's very common for people to come into that course who have done quite a bit of yoga training. And so it's not uncommon, as a result of that training, for people to have developed a habit of when they're resting or trying to meditate or to do savasana, corpse pose, to intentionally breathe longer or deeper. And, of course, in this practice, what we're doing, trying to do anyway, is we're trying not to fool around with our breath at all. You know, we're trying to be with our breath just as it is. So most people who are doing that don't know they're doing that. You know, they've developed a habit. You start in class, and as many times as you say, you know, don't control your breath, don't have you. You have to spot the people who are doing it and point it out to them and talk with them before they even recognize that they're doing it. You know, because our habits about our thinking and our body are so deep. So this is where the interface of language and experience come together, because in this practice, what we're going for is direct experience unmediated by thinking. The thinking comes afterwards to describe and talk about the experience that we've had. So this is not a practice where we're trying to create a model and then impose the model on our experience. Now, it's very important to have, a very sound structure in your mind of how the pieces of practice fit together. But that's really a different thing than trying to impose a model, like I'm supposed to have a particular experience, and I'm striving to make that experience happen. Okay. And the experience that we have is so much bigger than the language that we have to describe it. So, for example, and this is in the little handout as a reminder, we use the term, you know, turn your attention to your breath. And breath is an idea or a concept. You know, it is a shorthand referring to a multiplicity of sensations that are taking place at a multiplicity of locations as the air comes in the body, goes down into the chest, expands, the abdomen expands, the sidebars expand, you know, there's a lull, and then it goes out again. I mean, the number of different potential sensations that we can experience, it is enormous. So it's very easy and quite common for people to kind of just like lock on to the movement of the breath and maybe feel something happening, but not experiencing the range of sensations that are taking place. Is this working so far? Yeah? Everybody getting this? Okay. And this is really critical because our sitting practice and our mindfulness practice, the end game is to know what we're experiencing. So if we're not experiencing those sensations, what are we experiencing? Because that's what's going on when we're breathing. And if we're not experiencing those, what's probably happening is that we're lost in thought, or that we've lost our attention, and the attention is not well focused on the sensations of the breath, so the mind just gets lost in kind of a comfortable, relaxed, easy fog for a period of time. And so for me, that's always a test for me, is like, how awake am I to what I am actually experiencing in my body when I'm sitting and when I'm in daily life? And if the answer is, I'm disconnected from it, or I don't know, or it's very low, then I know there's something wrong with my mindfulness in either of those two locations. And so I would urge you to consider that, to watch the experience that you have. Even the term sensation is an idea or a concept, because sensation refers to not just a multiplicity of potential experiences, it refers to the multidimensional nature of them. And this is the reason it's so hard to describe many of our meditation experiences in language, unless we've got a lot of experience in trying to describe those accurately. So, you know, I may be following my breath, and I have a particular sensation in a particular part of the body, and I have a reaction or a triggering of an image or a thought which is linked to an emotion. So, you know, now I've got three or four dimensions going on, right? And so do I see that multidimensional nature of what's happening? You know, do I see that cause and effect triggering that's rolling out between these different dimensions of the body and the mind? Because that's what takes us home. As we begin to pay very close attention and to begin to see those patterns, we then start to have insight. and that insight eventually leads to recognition and wisdom. So, you know, in this particular tradition, we refer to intuitive insight, not insight that's arrived at cognitively, but arrived through this process, and we mean intuitive insight by wisdom. Those two terms are interchangeable. Okay. So, you know, sensation, we've all heard this, but sensations, maybe this is in a slightly different context tonight, in terms of being multidimensional, can have all these different qualities to it. They can have qualities or characteristics. Okay. So, something can have depth to it, you know, a sensation in the body. An emotion that's taking place can feel that it has a depth or it has a shallowness. It may have a temperature. If it's located in a particular place in the body, it will have a particular level of intensity. It may have a shape, you know. And there's a whole series of different dimensional characteristic qualities that it could have. And then there's a series of characteristics that it has. And I've written these down, and I'd like us to look at them because I want us to have a recognition of what they actually are. Okay. So, you know, if you're trying to pay attention to a sensation in your body that has this kind of multidimensional quality to it, one of the things that is going to start jumping out, if we can keep our attention there, right, which is the key, you know, some degree of continuity so we can see it, well, we begin to see that it changes. And not only that it changes, that it's changing all the time. You can take any emotion, any thought, any sensation in the body, put your attention on it, and it's going to change. There is no exception to that rule. Well, I guess there is one exception, and that is when there's no longer any animation in the body. Nobody left to experience it. But up until that time, you know, it's constant. Now, sometimes, you know, when we're sitting in meditation, particularly on retreat, it may feel like it's never going to change. It may feel like it's been going on for a couple of months. The next thing is, the next characteristic is that the qualities, these various elements that I'm talking about, flow from one into another rather than remaining stable. Or separate or permanent. So you've heard me say this before, but and I should go back and look at the song, but Michael Jackson, was the first one to do this, and he came out with a video, one of his songs, and it just has, maybe it's A Man in the Mirror, and it, because it shows a face, and then at some point it starts to change, and then it just, for the whole song, the rest of it, it just keeps morphing one face after another. So there's an Asian face, and that morphs into a white face, into a black face, into, you know, and it just keeps going, male, female, child, adult, what have you. It's very cool. And if we're paying attention, that's what we see when we're paying attention to sensation in the body and the mind. We just see, first of all, that it's changing and that it's morphing. You know, that it's moving from one thing into another. Now, frequently our attention isn't good enough to actually see the transition. So we feel like, well, gee, you know, I was experiencing an itch and now I'm experiencing a pain, you know, where there actually is this movement between the two, you know. So then as our attention becomes more refined and our ability to keep our attention actually in the experience, you know, not observing it from up in our head. It's not like, you know, if there's something happening in our knee, like we're watching it like this. It's that our attention's actually in the knee. And then the last one, that these continue to happen on their own without the direction of the conscious, and it should say conscious mind. Now, rather than admit that that was an omission on my part, I'm just going to act like I did that intentionally, so you'd have to write mind in there so you'd remember it. So they continue to happen on their own without the direction of the conscious mind. So if we take those three things together, what do they represent in terms of core issues that the Buddha said we have to awaken to if we hope to awaken? Any ideas? I mean, these are all obvious, right? And now, whether or not we're experiencing them may be another thing, but I mean, conceptually, they're not difficult to understand. And what they represent are anicca and anatta, impermanence, as the underlying foundation of all experience, including our sense of self, and anatta, or the application of these principles of cause and effect of how things are constantly in motion and in change, as applied to who we think we are as a separate entity. That actually that is not true, that our sense of self is just like one of these sensations. It is constantly changing. So, given the right set of circumstances, I'm a kind person. Given another set of circumstances, I'm a really irritated person. Given a particular set of circumstances, I think I'm a fantastic, well-motivated, well-intentioned Buddhist practitioner. And given another set of circumstances, I can't believe how miserable my conduct is. So all of it keeps changing, and our mind wants to define this as, well, it's all me. But actually, they're all different me's. So even if that piece is confusing, if we were actually to focus on those three things, like when we sit down to sit, we said to ourselves, this is going to be part of what I focus on during my sitting, to watch sensations and thoughts and emotions, and this aspect of them, that they're arising on their own. It's not because I'm choosing to make them to arise, that they're constantly changing, that they're never permanent, that they morph one into another, and this is all happening without my conscious mind. I mean, if we actually saw that and kept seeing it over and over again, we will start to have really significant insights about the nature of how and why we suffer and how and why we can point our minds into satisfaction and into happiness. And if we don't see those things, then our ability to do that is greatly diminished. Okay. So this element of sensations is just critical. And if your normal sitting is disconnected from your body and bodily sensations, I would urge you to consider exploring this and exploring it from this avenue. Because, as I think my handout last week said, it is not an accident that the first foundation of mindfulness is the body, including the breath. That's not an accident. And the reason is because it's foundational. It's where we live, you know. Now, in this culture, we're pretty much disembodied, which is to our disadvantage, and particularly to our disadvantage as practitioners. So I wanted to... there are two advertisements that I saw recently that I think give the two sides of this, okay? Both of them were in women's running magazines, okay? So the first ad shows a woman, and she's, I don't know if she's in Mendocino or Big Sur, and she's running through the forest, and, you know, there's a mist in the air, and I don't know how, but her hair is perfectly coiffed, you know. And she's got about $5,000 worth of running gear on by this one company. And then the tagline, you know, that's supposed to really catch your attention and want you to buy this clothing is, if you can just keep moving, the stress can't touch you. And, you know, I thought, how do a bunch of ad people get in a room around a conference room and go, yeah, hey, listen to this line. If you just keep moving, the stress can't touch you. And everybody goes, wow, that's so brilliant. So I still can't even understand that. If you just keep moving. So so that's one end, which is basically, oh, I'm going to run away from my stress. You know, I'm not going to engage it, you know. And I'm all for figuring out all kinds of ways of movement to, you know, help us deal with our stress. But that's not going to help us be embodied in experiencing our stress and dealing it from that perspective. So the other realm is it shows this little woman, you know, she, and it's from the back. So I'm guessing it looks like she's maybe in her late 20s, early 30s, and she's small. You know, she's maybe 5'2 or 5'3, and she's sweaty. You know, she just completely, she's out in the middle of the country. She's been running a long time, and I don't think that they just sprayed her with water. I mean, this kid looks like she's doing a workout, you know, and she's running. And then underneath is the following, which for me is almost a poem. And it starts out, and it says, in big print, my breathing. It says, I like listening to it. That's why I don't wear a headset or anything like it. I'd rather listen to me. My breathing is there for the same reason my running is, to remind me that I'm alive. And you know, in the end, that's what this practice is about. Is about figuring out how to be fully human and to expand the range of our experience. And the way that happens in this practice is first through our body. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with Pema Chodron. Let's see if I can find Pema's quote here. So Pema Chodron says, it's helpful to realize that this very body that we have, that's sitting here right now in this chair on a cushion with all of its aches and all of its pleasures, is exactly what we need to be fully human, fully awake, and fully alive. So it is the most exquisite tool, but we have to use it and we have to be embodied in it, you know, for that to happen. So the body can be this extraordinary gateway to experience, to a larger range of experience, and to the wisdom of the body and mind functioning together. Okay, so that's number one. Did you have a question? To emptiness?
Emptiness.
Now, there's another night that we have sometimes called Stump the Teacher. Okay, so, you know, although the Buddha used the term emptiness, you know, he tended to rely on anicca and anatta as opposed to emptiness. He led with those two, where some other traditions lead with emptiness. Okay, so the fundamental idea is that if these three things that I mentioned are true, you know, if everything is constantly changing, if everything is morphing one into another, and all of that is happening outside of our conscious control, that there is no permanent, constant element there. In other words, it is empty of permanency. It is always in transition. Does that help?
Yeah.
So that you know, not to go into a whole talk
right.
on it, but I mean, that's the fundamental idea.
Thanks.
Okay? All right. And then the second idea that I'd like to talk about is thought, and particularly the importance, and, you know, we normally don't talk this way, about monitoring and managing the content of our thought, okay? And I'll bet everybody thought here we weren't supposed to control anything, so, you know, what am I talking about? I've cited a number of suttas here that you can, you know, look at the original material, and there's some good material on our website. But from a Buddhist perspective, there are two kinds of thoughts. And there are those kinds of thoughts that point our mind towards balance and peace and satisfaction, and those thoughts that point our mind in exactly the opposite direction, into confusion, which we call ignorance, and to suffering. And so in any given moment, whether we're watching it or not, there's a choice, because our thinking affects us. And I'm sure we've all had the experience. I woke up this morning, and I've been dealing with a series of things that my mind my mind is defining as difficult and troubling. Okay, and I'm clear that at some level they are. And I'm clear at another level that my mind's, you know, just having a free-for-all of adding on and making it worse, you know, which is called what?
Catastrophizing.
Catastrophizing is called papancha, which is the proliferation, layering of thought, you know. So rather than catching that I'm thinking or I'm starting to catastrophize, I don't catch it. And then I wake up that I've been catastrophizing for the last 10 minutes, and where if I could have caught it earlier, I would have noticed that I was starting to have reactions in my body. But 10 minutes out, now my breath is shortened and my neck is stiff and my body's tense, okay? Because, you know, there's no separation between body and mind, okay? So paying attention to the content of thought and then what that's doing, you know, to our body, where it's pointing our mind becomes critical, and I submit to you that it becomes particularly critical in relationship to my opening comments about to live in interesting times is a curse. Okay? So I actually think now that we have to be very careful about our diet of information. You know, there's people that I talk to who have kind of lost control and are just, you know, looking at every news feed and announcement about a confirmation hearing and, you know, who said what, and you know, they're pretty agitated. And there's other people saying, I haven't listened to the news for years, and I'm not going to listen to this. And, you know, both of those, if we're at all interested in being, you know, a full human being, and we're at all interested in the United States of America and in the world, we can't afford either of those two positions. We can't afford to act like nothing's happening, and we can't afford to just be indiscriminately consuming all kinds of news that is driving us crazy. And this is where this idea about monitoring content and the body hook up together. Okay. Because if we develop and cultivate this awareness of the body, It then begins to carry over. If we do that in our sitting practice, which is kind of the formal way of developing it, and then we start to try to develop that in our daily life, and if we're working on it, our meditation practice, it'll just spontaneously start appearing in our daily life, where we will normally pick up that we're starting to get agitated, we're starting to get upset, we feel under pressure about something, is by what's happening in our body. Usually, it doesn't happen by us recognizing our thoughts, because we're so identified with our thoughts that we only wake up quite a bit of the way down the line and realize that we're lost in catastrophizing or angry thoughts or resentful thoughts. Where if we were actually in tune with our breath and our body, we would pick things up much earlier. And I mean, the simplest illustration is, you know, you go into work, you feel pretty good, and then at 2 o'clock you have a headache or a really stiff neck. And it's like, geez, why do I have a headache or a stiff neck? Well, something's been happening for hours, probably. And if we develop this body awareness that the Buddha encourages to do, we start picking this up earlier and earlier and earlier. And we start picking it up through sensations in the body. And it's really actually kind of a gorgeous thing, because we start to become quite familiar with our unique habits in relationship to our states of mind and our states of emotion. And so we'll start to have a particular experience in the body. And you know, one of the mindfulness in Pali, the original language that mindfulness was born into, has a number of different definitional elements to it, one of which is remembering. And it's not like remembering the past. It's like remembering to be embodied and to be awake in the present moment to the experience that's unfolding. That's the remembering in the definition of mindfulness. So when your mindfulness starts to really develop, you'll find that you will be unmindful. And then suddenly, you know, you just wake up. And oddly, you frequently wake up to what's happening at exactly the moment you need it. I mean, it's an absolutely fascinating thing that somehow the wisdom of the body and the mind, once it begins to understand and become accustomed to mindfulness, will call upon it to assist us when we need it the most. And then you start to see that, well, when I start to feel a certain configuration of sensations in my body, that's leading someplace. And so, like chronic pain patients, you know, there's a whole set of patterns that tend to develop with chronic pain patients, most of which are thought-driven. And then those thoughts cause whatever's present to feel much more intense and to ramp up much more quickly than if that was not present. And so, like in the mindfulness-based stress reduction programs, heavy, heavy focus on sensations in the body in relationship to pain and the impact of thinking and projecting out to the future about what this sensation right now in my body means and how that makes it worse, rather than just being with the sensations themselves and just allowing whatever's going to happen to take care of itself. You know? So this really becomes this extraordinary and powerful tool if we develop it. So I think that you can use the same thing with respect to thinking. Like, I woke up this morning, ostensibly had a fairly good night's sleep, And in the moment of waking up, I could see that my mind was obsessing negatively about something. You know, one of these circumstances that I mentioned that my mind is defining as difficult and problematic. So then I've got a choice. And I mean, I could really see it. It's like, you know, first of all, it's fascinating to me. It's like, I wonder how long this has been going on. You know, I wonder if, like, I've just been kind of a semi-awake position for a half hour, and I started thinking, or I wonder if, like, this thinking is actually coming out of my being asleep. You know, that my mind was obsessing about this while I was asleep. I don't know the answer to that. but I do know in that moment, I could very clearly see that if I allowed my mind to continue that thinking pattern and the content of it and the energy that that content was generating, I would be miserable the rest of the day. You know, and by early afternoon, I would really be miserable. I'd be physically miserable. So if you can see that, then you can do something about it. So I did. You know, I worked with my body for a while. I sat and I really watched during the morning. You know, like, is that coming back? You know, what is the quality of my thinking? How is it affecting my body and other thoughts that I'm having, you know, while I'm working? And then periodically I just take little breaks, you know, like I just meditate for 5 or 10 minutes. Just enough to break the cycle of whatever negatively it started to happen, you know. But the key to all of that is what? It's being able to see it, right? If you can't see it, which is the whole game with mindfulness, right? Can't see it, nothing you can do about it. You're going to wake up sometime later, and you've lost the opportunity to intervene with destructive or dysfunctional or unhealthy or problematic thinking or emotions when they were at a low level. You know, we talked last week about that quotation from the Dalai Lama where he said, you know, what we should be concerned about is not anger and rage, but dissatisfaction and discontent, because it is from dissatisfaction and discontent that anger and rage arise. So if you're already into anger or rage, it's a job to get out. If you can actually start, if we can start to train ourselves to notice discontent and then watch where discontent takes us, and we can notice dissatisfaction and watch where dissatisfaction takes us, then we have the basis for what? For the thing that during the night of the Buddha's awakening he said was the critical element of his awakening. You know, there were these three things that happened, but the one that allowed his mind to open to the nature of suffering and the causes of suffering, you know, like, what was that? And it was his mind piercing deeply into the process, you know, different names, but dependent origination or dependent co-origination, the process of how we personalize experience and then go unconscious. And the Buddha said that seeing that was the thing that set his mind free. Okay? So if we could actually begin, like if just as a practice, and you might try this, just say, okay, like today, what I'm going to do, when you put a little thing up on your computer, or I don't know, you know, if you don't have a computer and you've got a job where you're walking around, you write it on your palm. It just says discontent. It says dissatisfaction. Well, that's all I do. I just watch for that all day long. I don't have to do anything about it. You know, it's developing the ability to watch an experience. So just like, well, how often during the day do I experience some minor little discontent? And when I experience that, what happens? I mean, do I feel that someplace in my body? Does my mind just immediately see it and drop it, or does it tend to get a little stronger? And because I'm discontent about this, I'm now a little easier to be discontent about that. You know, is there a progression? So you just keep watching that. And I guarantee you that if you do that, you will really learn something. And so if we could watch those three elements of things changing, of them changing without our conscious control, how dissatisfaction and discontent lead to something stronger, we will inevitably, if we stay with it, we will begin to see the process of how those initial feelings of unpleasant or pleasant lead to attachment, up to desire and aversion, attachment, and then to identification or personalization. And it's that fundamental process of seeing that, of seeing how we do that, and then realizing that once we do that, we suffer. No exceptions to the rule if we do that. And once we get there, it is really hard to get out. But if we can catch it at any one of those stages before we get to full identification, we have the opportunity to deal with it. It's kind of exciting, you know. It's a lot of work. So here, I'm just going to close with this and then go to questions. So applying this to thinking, it seems to me to be pretty important, and I just have a couple of I've had these for years, and these are my favorite quotes about thinking that I think also are consistent with Buddhist thought. Okay. So first, William James, you know, the father of basically American psychology. A great many people think they are thinking when they are merely rearranging their prejudices. Always like that one. C.S. Lewis, you know, Christian theologian, philosopher. Part of every misery is, so to speak, the misery shadow or reflection. The fact that you don't merely suffer, but have to keep on thinking about the fact that you're suffering. I not only live each day in grief, but live each day thinking about living each day in grief. Alan Watts, you know, Methodist, an Anglican minister from England who eventually became, you know, arguably one of the best known Caucasian American Zen teachers. A person who thinks all the time has nothing to think about except thought. And then Sri Ramakrishna, and I mean, this is the best one. Thinking is a good servant, but a poor master. Okay, so a little discussion, questions. Are you?
Yeah, I'm trying to add this in the discussion we had last week. We were talking about thoughts and how we can manage our thoughts to relieve suffering. But yet, when I hear you tonight, can you tie the two together for me? You remember what we talked about? I know that session was pretty intense.
Yeah.
At times.
Yeah.
And maybe it just blew over me. But you remember what you said about thoughts? Three things. But you talked about wholesome thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Wholesome or skillful?
Yeah. I'm trying to connect the two.
Okay, all right, okay. So I'm actually saying the same thing using a little different language.
Okay.
Okay, so, you know, wholesome or skillful would mean, you know, thoughts that are pointing our mind in towards a direction of balance and peace and satisfaction, okay? And unwholesome or unhealthy or unskillful thoughts would be those that are pushing us into confusion or ignorance and struggle and suffering, okay? So in its simplest form, you know, I'll just report to you what I'm trying to do is, you know, is I'm trying to operationalize this, is in many of the things right now that are going on that I know have a very high probability of upsetting me, you know. And I have, you know, all of us have different browsers, but I have Bing. And Bing just has this little, small, little banner at the bottom. It has, I don't know, the top 20 or 30 stories and just this little thing, and then you can never have more than three words, you know. And so it'll have a description. So I can, it's kind of a test, okay? I can go up and look at that little banner, and I'll see a particular face and three words, and I can feel my body tighten up and my breath, you know, go down. So that's really instructive for me, you know. So then the next step for me is, first of all, okay, so I'm seeing my reactivity, and then the next step is making just kind of like a little quick experiential assessment. Is my mind and my body in a place today where I can open that up and explore that a little bit without my mind starting to go into proliferation? And sometimes I can. You know, sometimes I've got a lot of equanimity. I've had good sleep. I feel like I'm making some progress on projects, and you know, so you've got this kind of mental strength. And then there are other days, which I had the day before yesterday, where rightly or wrongly, you know, my mind feels like everything is going wrong, and I know that's not true, but that's the emotional feeling I've got. And I know that if I open that up and start reading that and exploring it, it's not going to be good for me. You know, it's just going to point me in the right direction. And unless I'm awfully careful, it's going to set me off. So, you know, for me, it's just a progressive choice. Like, just watching, like, am I having reactivity in some way to things? And then making an assessment. Well, what do I do with that? You know, and trying to both protect myself if my mind is not strong, and then cultivating, if my mind is strong, trying to cultivate, okay, how do I engage that material positively? You know, rather than just, I tend to be a person who gets very skeptical. And so I'll open some of these things up, and I'll notice after about the fourth sentence that, you know, my mind is just kind of like saying, what bullshit is that? You know, I can't believe that they would say that at a hearing. And so I've got to watch that, because I see that's taking me someplace. So how do I engage this material in the events from what we're actually trying to do in Buddhism, and that is stay present here in to the degree possible in a non-judgmental way for the end game of being able to actually see what's happening clearly, not see it through my prejudices or my fears or my reactivity. Because if I can't see it clearly, I can't make a sound decision. So just, you know, a constant all day long, right? You know, and some days it's all very easy and smooth, and other days, the whole day's a lot of work. Right? So.
You know, I feel no matter what I'm feeling, people are moving and going about their business, even if I get stuck. You know, people, you know, are noticing where I am. You know, everybody is out doing their own thing, and it seems to me all that's going on in the world and in my life, part of it is just I get stuck or I get frozen, and I'm meditating, and all of a sudden I'm meditating and I fall asleep, and I'm sleeping for 4 hours like I'm shocked or something. And how can I do anything? You know, it's like movement. Is that, you know, what's movement? You know, it's like can't even think beyond anything. And here I'm trying to meditate, or I'm meditating on this, and I'm feeling like I'm frozen.
Well, listen, I think all of us have those days, you know, where it's just too much, and our mind wants to shut down. And we need to know when we're having that kind of day, and then figure out what to do about it, okay? So if I see that I'm having that kind of day and that my mind wants to escape, in my own case, I realize that trying to sit in meditation may not be the best thing, because what may happen is exactly what you reported, you know, that my mind just wants to shut down. So that doing some movement or doing some yoga, which forces me to stay awake and then try to stay in my body, which pulls me out of the type of thinking and emotions that are taking me down, tends to help me start to get back in balance. So, you know, I'm always looking for what do I need to do to try to stay in the center ground, you know, to have some sense of equanimity and balance. Because once I lose that, if it's excitement, then my judgment's not very good. And if it's in the other direction, it's even worse. Yeah.
So. I have a couple observations that I wouldn't mind you commenting on. You mentioned how disembodiment tends to lead to proliferation of thought. So in my experience, when I'm able to stay with the sensations of the body, there tends to be a calming down of the thought.
Right.
And then it's like if I can see the sensation and stay with it, it kind of dissipates in itself. And I've noticed that also if I can stay with the sensation of the breath, that there is also a calming of the breath. Whereas I'll notice before I'm able to just stay with the sensation, I'll notice before that there's like a subtle manipulation, like there's like a habit of breathing in quicker or trying to kind of force the inhalation or the exhalation, but it's almost like out of habit. And it's when I'm actually sitting there noticing like, hey, I don't really need to take a breath right now, and the breath comes of itself and then it goes out of itself, then there's like a calming down of that.
Right.
I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah. So I don't know if everybody was able to hear this, but this was a good practice report. And basically what he said is that whether it's a sensation on the body or his breath, if he can stay with the actual experience of the sensation in the way that I was talking about it at the beginning of my talk, that what that tends to do is allows the mind and the body to settle and to calm down. And the reason that's happening is that if you can stay in the sensation rather than trying to manipulate it or change it, that the energy in the mind starts to collect, it starts to settle, and it starts to concentrate. And as it does that, one of the side effects is a sense of calmness and stability. And the your comment about that the thoughts settle as well is exactly right. And in the handout, one of the suttas that's mentioned is the Honeyball Sutta. And the Honeyball Sutta, in that the Buddha basically says, is that our first defense against feeling in the body, because generally, you know, we've been trained not to want to stay there, is to go up into thinking, which leads to proliferation and then identification, and then we're suffering, you know. But if we can stay in the sensation, that it retards that process, and if we catch it, we can actually reverse it by just staying in the sensation. Yep. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Did you have one more?
Oh, no, I was just going to ask you, so how do you think the press conference went?
Margaret had a question.
I think I'm going to ask for another question. whatever news agency you work for, it's terrible. It's terrible. Good. One more, and then we'll call it quits.
Okay. And I want to make sure that I understood you correctly, but then I have a question based on what I think you said. You were talking about being able to catch a thought that's beginning to proliferate, or a bodily sensation, and you can open it up and explore it, and that will form some, that will help you track down what's going on.
Okay. So I want to combine these two. So let's say that I notice that my mind's starting to proliferate. Okay. Rather than staying in the content of thought, if I can open up to my whole body and experientially ask, well, what's happening in my body now and where, and then staying with that sensation, then what that will tend to do is retard the growth of the proliferation. And if we catch it early enough, it will tend to cut it off.
And the second part I thought I heard was that if you're having one of those days where you think to yourself, "I'm always having one of these days," you know, when you really have gone down that, and you're feeling really that upset, I thought I heard you say not to open it up.
Yeah. I think.
I wondered if you could expand on that.
You know, for me, there's a lot of ways to word this, but for me, I'm always looking at if I wake up and I know I'm going to have a bad day, or I feel like I'm having a bad day, I'm looking at the issue of vulnerability. Okay, so like, am I vulnerable to proliferation and identification and suffering and confusion? And if my answer to that is, yeah, I can see that I am, then I'm just very careful about my diet of what I take in. So like that little Bing thing that I was talking about, I probably won't look at that day. Or I'll look at it and there will be, the only thing that I'll open up is something that's humorous or social or something, you know, something that makes me feel like I'm nourishing myself to help me get a little bit stronger.
So it's not that you won't explore what's making you feel that day, it's that you do the best. You do practice self-care to make sure that your vulnerabilities are not assaulted.
That's right.
But it's not.
Yeah. So you're not disassociating yourself from the baseline experiencing you're having. In fact, it's just the reverse, because you're really looking at that closely to make an assessment, right? And then if the assessment is, you know, I'm just vulnerable today, then you're watching what to avoid so you don't trigger yourself, and what can I do to make myself feel stronger, more nourished, better? You know, so like I'll go for more walks. You know, I'll look at a couple little movies I have of my grandson. You know, it's like I'm looking for something to change the energetic nature of what's happening in my system. Yeah. Okay, so I've got to cut it off. So, but we can talk afterwards. So I want to thank everyone for coming. Thanks very much. In a world where there is so much suffering, particularly with children, may our efforts here to look at ourselves and to carry that out into those around us can contribute in a very real way to the elimination of suffering and the creation of some more happiness and satisfaction in the world. So thank you.